When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Let's be lovers. Yeah. Just might hear me say, let's be lovers. Let's be lovers.
Let's be
This song is Let's Be Lovers by Talia's Van and the Bright and Morning Star Band. And I'm Joseph L. Flatley, and you are listening to Failed State Update. Today I'm joined by author and raconteur Mark Jacobson. As a journalist, he's He's written for New York Magazine, Village Voice, National Geographic. As an author, he's known for a number of books, including The Lampshade, a Holocaust detective story from Buchenwald to New Orleans, which comes highly recommended, and Pale Horse Rider, the biography of William Cooper. He also contributed to my book about Gabriel Fiorentia called New Age Grifter. He wrote the introduction, in which he addressed the mythic Woodstock of frustrated rock stars who become cult leaders. And that's the subject of today's episode.
Anybody who ever went to any of these gigantic rock concerts, like from Woodstock on, which there have been millions, you know, come out of it. And then they say, you mean you went to Burning Man? Oh, now you're part of my group, you know? I mean, there's this kind of little chip in there in the human species that seems to want to do this on some level, and because it keeps happening, right? So, you know, and it probably will happen forever. So, you know, music is interesting, and always, if you want to be a cult leader, of course, you want to be the center of attention. Your narcissism, so like, you know, who's more, you know, David Bowie comes out on the stage. I mean, he's the center of attraction. You know, he's any of these famous rock and roll stars. So why not do it? So, you know, somebody like Charles Manson, he actually was a very talented guitar player. One of the things that people don't really know about him, you know, he actually was a talented guitar player. I mean, David Koresh, for instance, who kept his group together through music, was not a very talented guitar player. And you can hear it in the music. But, you know, on the other hand, if you're operating in the people's temple, and that one of the things you might play today, the music from the People's Temple Choir, that's a Jim Jones thing for people that don't know. I mean, that stuff, it's not first grade gospel music, but it's good. I mean, people would assume that most cult music is terrible. But that's not really the case. I mean, for instance, one person we could talk about is Jeremy Spencer. Jeremy Spencer was an original guy from Fleetwood Mac. He was recruited by Peter Green, if you're a fan of this kind of, like, you know, that kind of guitar music. Peter Green is basically considered to be one of the three or four best guys ever, better than Jeff Beck or Jimmy Page or any of these cats. So he recruited Jeremy Spencer for the original Fleetwood Mac with Mick Fleetwood and John McVie, long before Stevie Nicks and all this other stuff. And they would go around. And one day, Spencer was mostly a slide guitar player in the Elmore James version mode. And he was considered to be one of the best, I mean, of these British guys, you know, easily the equal of Eric Clapton. So, and then one day he didn't show up for a gig and they didn't hear from him for months. And he was in the Children of God, which for people that follow this kind of stuff is probably one of the most notorious of all cults. And he still actually is alive and has ties to them. But if you listen to his music that he did for when he was, I think he released a record called Jeremy Spencer and the Children, which has a lot of good songs on it. You'd never know. I mean, you'd never know. And with the People's Temple Choir, I mean, there's some of them, not all of them are great, but I mean, there's some of them are just, you know, wow, what do I care what the philosophy of this group is? I like the music, you know?
Let's listen to a little Jeremy Spencer and the Children.
Okay.
One, two, three, four.
I'm looking at the Jeremy Spencer and the Children cover right now, and it's like a cartoon picture of a guy in a robe with like a sigh, like the Grim Reaper, and it's just surrounded by like all this American culture, like fast cars and electric guitars and riot cops and motorcycles, and then like two little children in diapers like pointing at the Grim Reaper.
Well, you know, it's just that what the Children of God was, they were kind of one of those Luddite cults, you know, that we've got to go back to the garden type thing, you know, sort of similar to Pol Pot in a weird way, because he was a let's pave it. We have to pave it all over and start again because the society is too ruined, you know, even in Cambodia where they didn't have any cars or rock and roll. You know, he thought that, you know, it was too far gone as far as he was concerned, you know. Don't talk about apocalyptic cults. I mean, they people like running around and like, you know, with 14 followers in the U.S., have nothing on a guy like Pol Pot, you know. So, you know, he managed to wipe out 1/3 of the entire country. So, you know, there's all different levels of scale on this. I mean, if you want to really talk about the king of all would-be rock and rollers who later became known as a cult leader, is Charles Manson, totally. And everybody, I mean, most people that have even a passing knowledge of Manson and his, you know about him killing Roman Polanski's wife and all that stuff, and Helter Skelter and this kind of stuff. Because actually Manson actually rejected that Helter Skelter idea because he said that he was really a Frank Sinatra fan and he didn't really like the Beatles. So, you know, so. But anyhow, it might be interesting if you want to cue it up there, DJ, to pick up a Manson song called Cease to Exist.
Pretty girl, pretty, pretty girl. Cease to exist. Just come and say you love me. Give up your world. Come on, you can't be. I'm your kind, oh, your kind, and I can see. Walk on, walk on. I love you, pretty girl. My life is yours, and you can have my world. Never had a lesson I ever learned. But I know we all get our turn. I love you. Never learn not to love you. Submission is a gift. Go on, give it to your brother. Love and understanding is for one another. I'm your kind. I'm your kind. I'm your brother. I ever learned, but I know we all get our turn, and I love you. Never learn not to love you. Never learn not to love you. Never learn not to love you.
And of course, that was Charles Manson, Cease to Exist. And there's an interesting story behind that one.
That song is a song that Manson played for Dennis Wilson, the, you know, of the Wilson brothers, of the Beach Boys, you know, probably, you know, some people would go to their grave swearing that they were the greatest single American rock and roll band ever. I can't really complain with that because Brian Wilson was totally a genius. He just is. So in any event, Dennis Wilson, the only Beach Boy that ever really surfed, was a kind of madman, like to ride around in his car, in his very fast, cool-looking car, and pick up teenage hitchhikers and take them back to his apartment and his gigantic house. And, you know, more or less, you know, if they wanted to screw, he was happy to do it, you know. So, like, one day he picked up these two girls that happened to be Manson girls. I'm not going to go through the whole business about the Manson girls, but Manson girls, and he brought them back to his house and, you know, they did the deed of whoever. And then he said, look, I got to go out, but you guys can stay here and hang out if you want. So Wilson came back home a few hours later, and there was a gigantic bus, a big black bus out parked out in front of his house. And there were all these Manson people in there. In his house. And then Charlie came out and says, oh, you're Dennis Wilson, man. You know, I'm a rock and roll guy too, man. Can I play you a song? And he said, Wilson is like, you know, oh, yeah, sure, man. So like, and I don't know exactly the full legend of this, but one of the songs that he played him was this song called Cease to Exist. And Wilson said, I love that song, man. That's great. I'm going to get the rest of the guys together and we're going to record that. So the Beach Boys actually did record this song. It no longer was called Cease to Exist. It's now called Never Learn Not to Love.
Cease to exist.
I guess after the Manson thing happened, they were desperate to get Manson's name off the record. so you have to look at this kind of stuff. And I know, I got to say, for the people that know about this stuff, they really tend to know a lot about it. So if I'm wrong about this, you know, I'm sorry. I'm doing my best. You know, if you can listen to the Cease to Exist record, which is also available on Spotify and anyplace else, And then you can hear the Beatles version, I mean, the Beach Boys version of it, which is called Never Learn Not to Love. And there are a couple versions around, I do believe. One is a cappella, that they just sing the lyrics, which are somewhat changed, I think. But so you see how this stuff kind of leaks into, like, a guy like Jeremy Spencer and Manson and the Beach Boys. You see how it leaks into the mainstream all the time. They're not just these lunatics out there, you know, doing this campfire music, because that might have been fine back in the 14th century. But now we're living in the 21st century and the 20th century with all this tech stuff. I mean, one thing that people don't really understand or really know is that the actual machinery to make records or recordings is only about 110 years old. You know, in other words, you couldn't hear any music at all, except if you actually were there to watch it being played until around, you know, on any kind of large level until around 1915 or something like that. So when you think about cult music and there and the range of this society building thing that these people are interested in doing, you have to keep that in mind. And it's so much easier now, obviously. And the leakage into the mainstream culture and that kind of crossover thing becomes kind of interesting to track that.
Mm-hmm. Let me play you a tune here. Of course, that's Boney M. Are they German or something?
I think they were German, but they could have been Swiss. If you want to find the origin of that song that you just heard, you've got to go back to probably 2,500 years ago, at least. I'm not exactly sure on the dates of the date that the people of Babylon. You know, Nebuchadnezzar, these names may ring a dim bell from Sunday school or something like that. They attacked what's now Israel and sacked Jerusalem back in 500 BC or something like that. So and they took away a lot of the Jews that were living there. They made them what they called which later became dhimmis, which were like wards of the state, because they weren't like they weren't the Putin people, like, you know, just the modern warfare where they just kill everybody. These people would go around and they would like take the valuable people and they would like bring them back. And these people from at that time in Jerusalem included a lot of these guys that became prophets in the Bible, including Ezekiel, Isaiah, Jeremiah. These are all Babylonian captivity writers who wrote and then had their stuff put in the Bible. And that's the way if anybody is interested in reggae music, which we'll get to in a second, that whole thing about Babylon, man, Babylon, that whole idea of that bad thing is from that period of time. So this psalm, which is attributed to Jeremiah, I do believe, this is Psalm 137 from the Holy Bible. And the lyrics, the words are, by the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. Where there were on the poplars, we hung our harps, for there our captors asked for us songs, our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, sing us one of the songs of Zion. So now that is a classic situation of oppression, because not only are these guys holding you slaves, but they're asking you to sing songs that were very important to you in your real natural milieu of like living as a, you know, Hebrew in Jerusalem. And they're mocking you by making you sing one of these songs, you know, and you've seen the situation plenty of times, you know? So it's kind of the opposite of when they sing the Marseillaise in Casablanca, because that's an act of rebellion among the Germans that are holding the place. This is like a kind of total mockery, like, you know, Yeah, yeah. So I'll get up there and sing us one of the songs you used to like, you know, and the people wouldn't do it. So, and then, you know, so this song became a kind of like very important song in certain colonial, this psalm for people, Bible readers in colonial settings became a big deal. And probably the single greatest articulation of this song appears in a 1970 version of Rivers of Babylon by a group called the Melodians, which is that song. If anybody has ever seen the movie, The Harder They Come, that song is in there. And can you get that song? So I would submit that that version is somewhat superior to the Boney M version, but you know, everybody has their own taste. So you got this thing which comes really out of the deepest hearts of you know, group identity and stuff like that. And the Melodians are singing it as Rastafarians in Jamaica, a colonial society, and they are directly, you know, picking it up from this Babylonian captivity. They use the word captivity in their song, which is not in the original psalm, for instance, because there was no way to, it was only after looking back that you can claim it was the Babylonian captivity. So when Boney M, you know, basically, I don't think there is an, and they're just machines. So they pick it up and they do whatever they do with it. And it, that's a hit song. Now, Now that's a topic for another session here, but you know, when you get down to the cult level, the modern day cult level, you know, the power of those kind of, that kind of history, even if you don't happen to know it, becomes very palpable. And especially if you feel like you're the only people around and you're in an evil environment of the United States, you live sort of like, say, in a place called Waco, Texas, you know, where, you know, you're not well liked, you know, and you're kind of a combative Seventh-day Adventist, Latter-day Seventh Adventist, like what you call the Branch Davidians. So David Koresh, actually, who was a kind of a Manson-esque kind of figure in the terms that he had to make rock and roll songs to hold his group together, he recorded a record, a full album called Songs for Grandpa. And he actually does a version of Rivers of Babylon, which I hope we have here.
Oh, we have it. Don't worry.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Here it is, Rivers of Babylon by David Koresh.
By the rivers of Babylon, that was the time. Yea, we wept, we remembered Zion. We hung harps upon the willows in the Mistara, for there they that carried us away, the quiet of us a song. They that carried us captive, the quiet of us birth, saying, sing unto us what songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land, the land of the beast, oh, the land of man? Revelation 18:1, the rising of the sun, glorious throughout the land, long as we serve man. If I ever forget thee, Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I not make thee above my chief joy, let my tongue continue to my mouth. Jerusalem, you are the apple of my eye, you are the passengers of life from the beginning. Help us all to understand that you will stand forever. Revelation 18:1, the rising of the sun, glorious throughout the land, long to we serve man. No longer is left to sell land. Oh, Father, deliver us out of Babylon, stand waiting for deliverance. We shall return out of this land. By the rivers of Babylon, by we sit down. Yea, we went, but we remembered Zion. We hung our hearts upon the wheels of the despair of. For daddy to carry us away required of us a soul. David carried us captive required of us birth. So he'd sing unto us one of the songs of Zion. How to receive the Lord's soul in a strange land, the land of peace. Oh, the land of man. How shall we see?
Wow, that was like the.
What'd you think of that?
Yeah, it's unrecognizable. It was like the bar band ballad version or something.
The jam band version of this story. But I mean, if he was singing that as the ATF was, like, you know, storming his compound, I don't know if he really rallied a lot of people, you know. But but I mean, you know, he's trying. I don't know, you know. It just seems interesting to me the way a song or kind of feeling like that would, like, you know, meander through 25 years of history and wind up, you know, with David Koresh as, and then, you know, what happened to him, and, you know, which was actually clearly a nightmare. But it's just kind of fascinating. But I don't know. I mean, he really took all the funk out of it.
Yeah, it's like he didn't realize why it was a good song. It's like he didn't realize why that was a good song. So he somehow managed to take out everything about it that was good.
He got all the words from the song. That was his source. Because he's an originalist, you know, in that stupid way that people are, you know. So he made sure he got all the lyrics in, you know, because that was the Bible, is the holy word. He didn't realize that popular music and what's in the Bible are two different things, my friend. So, you know.
Yeah.
Just to go back to Dwight Yorke, because I think it's really kind of like an interesting comparison, because Yorke is a Mr. Yorke is currently, sir, is currently, you can go talk to him now if you write a letter, because he's currently incarcerated in the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado, where he shares, probably is, you know, 20 feet away from the Unabomber and a few other Arab terrorists where they stick these people. Dwight Yorke was convicted of, similarly to David Koresh in a lot of ways, from the point of view of the authorities, Dwight Yorke was convicted. He's the largest, I do believe it still holds a record, the largest single child molestation case in the history of the United States. Dwight Yorke is a guy who starts from out of the what they call the Moorish movement of black culture, that's part of the black, came out of the black Muslims, and it's something that has run through black culture in America, at least for the past 100 years, in various circumstances, everywhere from Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali to people like Dwight Yorke. And so Yorke, you know, he's got at least 20. Actually, the entry about him on Wikipedia, of all things, is not that, it's a decent thing. You should probably, if you want to catch up on who Dwight Yorke is, you should probably read that, because it does introduce the topic in a lot of ways. He's a guy who's written over 200 books. He's got about 20 aliases. He's most well known, I guess, as the Dr. Malachi Z. Yorke, which he added an E to the name Yorke. And, there are many, many other Arabic and non-Arabic aliases. So one of the things about Dwight Yorke is a lot of these people, they start the cult and then they want to get into show business because they kind of realize the connection there. Dwight Yorke was in show business, and he went, then when he failed, as more or less failed, he began doing this other stuff. So, and it was slightly, there was an overlap there, But York he came up basically during the disco period. So these songs won't sound anything like the kind of other cult songs, which are trying to really, you know, tug it, you know, like the way the Koresh sang that song. He's trying to get those people to buy into that thing, regardless of how horrible the version of the song is. So York and disco music, at least as practiced by a lot of kind of third and fourth rate practitioners like Dwight York, is really kind of impersonal. And the whole idea is you're supposed to move around on the dance floor and not really think too much about the music. What was the name of his hits? Non-hits. Don't Stop the Something. I can't remember.
Don't Stop My Love by Passion.
Don't Stop My Love. And then there was a kind of follow-up one which actually charted at number 43 on the R&B charts. So maybe we could play a little bit of that, just so then we talk a little bit more about him. What did you think of that?
Yeah, it definitely did not sound like Charles Manson or David Koresh.
No, it's a kind of, you can't really say this because lyrics of songs are neither here nor there. You just want to make the words rhyme, sort of. But I mean, there's words, there's little things like, you know, you can't stop it. You know, it's going to take over. But
Sure. Definitely knowing where he ended up, the lyrics take on like some of the lyrics take on like a different, more sinister meaning.
See, the thing is that like you come out of a certain kind of, you're trying to attract the people that you want to attract. So if you think that white people are the blue eyed devils, you know, if you're going to go with this Barry White type thing, you know, it's kind of like, and if you see pictures of Dwight York during this period, I mean, he actually does look a lot like Barry White. So like, much, much more put together in a lot of ways, but because he's not fat, right? He's like, looks like a kind of lover boy type. So, shortly after this record, and this was recorded by a group called Dwight York and the Passion, sometimes just called the Passion. And but shortly after this, I think this record came out, I'm not exactly sure what the date of this tune is, but Dwight York did other things. Like he took his they're kind of Egyptologists, what they call Kemetic believers, that the real civilization of the world starts in Egypt, which is a lot of stuff right out of the kind of Elijah Muhammad playbook and stuff like that. And there's still a Dwight York kind of inspired temple on Bushwick Avenue. For those who are listening to this that live in New York, you can go right past and it's freshly painted. Somebody's keeping it up as the great leader is whiles away the rest of his days in the Supermax. You know, they're still, you know, going there, and there's always a table among the many tables of booksellers on 125th Street, which is the main drag of Harlem, where they always have like booksellers who sell these kind of, you know, black oriented material. You know, there's always the Nuwabians. That's the name of his group. And, you know, there's the Nuwabian bookseller who's selling the 6 million books written, attributed to Dwight York, of which several are straight out of the normal conspiracy, you know, what we would consider normal conspiracy stuff. You know, he's got stuff about how we didn't land on the moon. He's got all, you know, A to Z, the whole thing. So, and he's a fascinating figure in a sense because, you know, he adopted some of the traits of these dominantly white, you know, white oriented groups, and kind of translated into this black thing, or the other way around. I'm not really sure. You know, these things work together. You never really can parse them out. But he's very little known, and people talk all about Manson and Koresh and all these things. Nobody, he's never mentioned basically because nobody ever pays attention to him. But if you go uptown, everybody knows who Dwight York is. And so, or at least, you know, to say two things about him. Oh, yeah, that guy. You know, so it's just a fascinating thing.
Have you seen the pictures of his compound in Georgia? Tama Ray. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. The big black pyramid and everything. Like, he really... You know, that's the mark of a great cult leader is...
He could build his own city.
Mm-hmm.
He got his... I once wanted to make a movie about this. He got his followers from Harlem and Brooklyn and said, we're not going to put up with this crap anymore. We're going to go build our own world. And it's in Putnam County, Georgia. I don't know what the demographics are, Putnam County, Georgia, but and they built this whole, you know, kind of Disneyland of Dwight York philosophy. And it lasted only a couple of years. I have a feeling that there was some local pressure and maybe they just ran out of money and stuff like that. But, it's just like he's really a for anybody who's interested in these kind of cult and fringe groups, I mean, you know, studying the Dwight York story is really it's imperative, I say, because he's been unfairly neglected.
Is he one of the figures, you know, you talk about the Moore Science Temple and like that whole...
Yeah, he comes out of that.
Does he specifically kind of influence hip-hop music, like, in a direct way, or...?
Well, I don't... You know, that's a good question, because, you know, if you look at the... I mean, for instance, anybody who... is really wants to talk about this I think people in my readings and my, say, 35 years of listening to hip hop music, maybe more now. It's kind of strange that hip hop music has been around for almost 50 years, but from since Kool Herc in the South Bronx, which is in the late 1970s now. So, but all those guys. And you can just run through the names of them, like Nas and, you know, Mobb Deep and Wu-Tang for sure. All these Eastern-based, almost all Eastern-based hip-hop people are, and that could have been one of the big reasons why there was this East Coast-West Coast battle. You know, remember that back in the 90s or so, that supposedly was behind, or at least had some factor in the deaths of Tupac Shakur and Biggie Smalls. It's because the Eastern people, the scientists, the people like Wise Intelligent and, you know, all these guys, I mean, really anybody you can mention, were followers of the 5%er movement. 5%er movement comes straight out of the black Muslims. In fact, the founder of the 5%er movement, a guy named Clarence 13X, who later became Father Allah. He was working at the Temple Number 7 on 116th Street in Harlem when Malcolm X was the chief minister there. So, and then they kicked him out because he liked to smoke weed and a few other things that were against the rules. So he just started his own religion, more or less, and picking up many of the things from the those teachings. And but you were allowed to smoke weed. So then you suddenly, like, you know, his mind expanded. You got the discipline, the idea that white people were not the original people, you know, that Black people were the original people, and that all that cosmology and, you know, crisis cults kind of stuff. Not saying it's not true, please. I, you know, it could be true. And and then you merge that with weed smoking, and you've got, oh my, how can you fail to start a movement? So it's going to happen, you know, because people just, I mean, one thing about marijuana, and, you know, I probably get in trouble for saying this, but one thing about marijuana, and I am a stoner from way back, is that there's no doubt in the world that it makes you paranoid. It does make you. This is an underrated factor of the entire reason why people hate everybody. I mean, it's like a drug of love, but in the end of the day, it points out all the hypocrisy and the conspiracy stuff that the other side of people you don't like are trying to screw you. And, you know, not all the time, of course, you know, but it does have that aspect to it. And if you look through it, you'll find a lot of paranoid thinking that among stoners, you know, regardless of how they express it. So, you know, there you got this movement of people that are, I mean, that's one of the main reasons why Bill Cooper, William Cooper's, which that's how we first met, Lenny and I, because I wrote this book about Bill Cooper, this radio guy, and sort of like the father of the truth movement. But one of the great claims to fame for his book, Behold the Pale Horse, was that it was the most read book in prison among Black people. It was not among white people. I mean, I don't care what you people out there in you know, Bill Cooper followers in Great Britain or wherever, you know, this was like, you know, because it was like he was speaking right to the prisoner. In other words, like, we are imprisoned by things that we both understand and don't understand. And that was very, it was very palpable to people that are already in prison. And if you're a Black person in America, you know, you're right. You know, I think that's a good reason to be paranoid. So, you know, so this just played into that whole thing. So that whole business with the Cooper stuff kind of runs through this cult, the, you know, and the 5%ers. I mean, what's his name? Prodigy, the guy from Mobb Deep, you know, who wrote, he and his buddy wrote probably the most effectively fear, the Shook Ones Part Two is probably the most scary, one of the greatest scary hip hop songs of all time.
Hold up, son. Word. Yeah. To all the killers and the $100 billers. For real, niggas who ain't got no feelings. Feelings.
Just watch my back, I got your foot.
Check it out now. Stuck off the realness, we be the infamous, you heard of us, official Queensbridge murderers, the mob comes equipped for warfare, beware of my crime family who got enough shots to share for all those who wanna profile and pose, rock you in your face, stab your brain with your nose bone, you all alone in these streets, cousin, every man for himself in his land, we be gunning, and keep them shook crews running like they supposed to, they come around but they never come close to, I can see it inside your face, you're in the wrong place, cowards like you just get their whole body laced up with bullet holes and such. Speak the wrong words, man, and you
will get touched. You can put your whole army against my team, and I guarantee you it'll be your very last time breathing. Your simple words just don't move me. You're minor, we major. You're all up in the game and don't deserve to be a player. Don't make me have to call your name out. You're cool as featherweight. My gunshots will make you levitate. I'm only 19, but my mind is older. When the things get for real, my warm heart turns cold. Enough nigga deceased, another story gets told. It ain't nothing really. And yo, done sparked the Philly. So I could get my mind off these yellow back niggas. While they still alive, I don't know, go figure. Meanwhile, back in Queens, the realness and foundation. If I die, I couldn't choose a better location. When the slugs penetrate, feel a burning sensation. Getting closer to God in a tight situation now. Take these words home and think it through. Or the next rhyme I write might be about you. Son, they shook. Cause ain't no such thing as halfway crooks. Scared to death and scared to look. They shook. Cause ain't no such thing as halfway crooks. Scared to death and scared to look. Living the life that of diamonds and guns. There's numerous ways you can choose to earn funds. Some get shot, locked down, and turn nuns. Cowardly hearts and straight up shook ones. Shook ones. He ain't a crook, son. He just a shook one. For every rhyme I write, it's 25 to life. There was so much to got to trust, safeguard of my life. Ain't no time for hesitation, that only leads to incarceration. You don't know me, there's no relation. Queens, Red Tempest, don't play. I don't got time for your petty thinking, my son, I'm bigger than those. Claiming that you pack heat, but you're scared to hold. And when the smoke clears, you be left with one and you don't. 13 years in the projects, my mentality is what, kid? You talk a good one, but you don't want it. Sometimes I wonder, do I deserve to live? Or am I going to burn the hell for all the things I did? No time to dwell on that, cause my brain reacts. Front if you want, kid, lay on your back. I don't fake jazz, kid, you know I bring it to your life. Stay in a child's place, kid, you out of line. Criminal minds thirsty for recognition. I'm sipping, E and J got my mind flipping. I'm bucking, digging my ways out of hope for hustling. Get that loot, kid, you know my function. As long as I'm alive, I'ma live illegal. And once I get on them, I put on all my peoples. React quick, spill lyrics like Max, I hit your domo. When I roll up the beat, go sleep because I'm free. Son, they shook. This ain't no such thing as halfway crooks. Scared to death and scared to look. They shook. This ain't no such thing as halfway crooks. Scared to death and scared to look. They shook. This ain't no such thing as halfway crooks. Scared to death and scared to look. They shook. This ain't no such thing as halfway crooks. Living the life that of diamonds and guns. There's numerous ways you can choose to earn funds.
So, you know, you listen to that and it, you know, the image is like some kind of film noir, people like walking around. It's not the safe territory. You know, the lighting is, it's in black and white for sure, you know. So, I mean, this guy, the guy that's rapping there, Mr. Prodigy, who's no longer with us, unfortunately, because he was a great genius. I asked him, I talked to him, I interviewed him, and I said, is it true that you read Behold the Pale Horse 4 times? He said, no, that's not true. I said, really? And he said, I read it 6 times because I wanted, because he said that before he was stood up there, he wanted to be right and correct, which is a 5% of term. You know, you want to be right and correct, you know, to build, which is also another 5% of term, to build your whatever thesis you're coming up with here. And that comes straight out of the pot smoking land of Clarence 13X, which is that guy, Dwight York, is kind of like a, you know, he's a weird offshoot of all that kind of thinking. And because he's got so much ego that he can't, you know, give it up to the other people. He's got to be the boss. And I think that's a combustible, that's a combustible combination there. And, you know, I don't know if he really assaulted 235 underage women or men, or, but, you know, he's in Florence right now, probably thinking it all about it or not, because he's still writing books even from there. So, you know, as I say, again, he's a topic for further research. So anyhow, why don't you play a cut from the People's Choir?
Something.
I mean, you know, what's wrong with that? I mean, that's Jim Jones. You know, that's Jim Jones's church before they go to Guyana and kill themselves. So, you know, 900 and something people kill themselves. Probably some of them were in that choir singing that song. So you think about this cult music stuff. And, you know, it's about building community. Nothing builds community like gospel music. I mean, it just does. And in fact, you could say, I mean, it depends on how you feel about Christianity, but you could say that almost every hymn ever written is a cult piece of cult music. So, like, you know, you could do that. I don't think that would be very profitable, but you could say that. You know, and this kind of stuff, I mean, this is like pretty much not, it's not as, it's not the Soul Stirrers or the Dixie Hummingbirds, but it's good. You know, it's if you walked into a church and you heard that, you'd be happy. So Jim Jones is, you know, the director of that band. He's the one that put them together. He's the one that gives them the love that they can express, you know, and he's also the one that tells them to drink the Kool-Aid. So you're dealing with these very, complex situations, especially when you look at it from a cultural point of view, about these cult leaders. So, you know, I think that your guy Gabriel, I mean, certainly play one of his tunes. I mean, I don't know where he fits into this, but he seems to be, it's mostly all about him. So that's kind of a lower form of cult music, I would say, you know, but they are, I don't mean to denigrate him. I mean, maybe he's a great artist. We just don't see it. but maybe. But I mean, the other thing is, like, it's like very confusing music. When you add music into a an existing thesis, you know, it just blows up your dialectic because it appeals to on so many different levels. You know, you could be listening to, I mean, I don't know. Some people like the Rolling Stones. Some people like the Beatles. You know, it was like and you don't even know why. I mean, intellectually, yeah, I want to like the Rolling Stones because the Beatles are sappy. But you know, it's I don't know. You know, it's just there's a lot of questions to be brought in there, and you know, you can't. I don't think you can really put a group together that's without this component or something else. You know, I mean, you could. What other art form is there that does this? I mean, you can have a cult of painters. I don't know, you know, that doesn't seem like it's going to work because by the time you start painting your picture, you know, you're going to be doing your own thing. You're not doing it with other people. So the collectiveness of it, and even with a guy like Gabriel, I mean, once he's singing his song and everybody's and the part of the chorus where everybody's singing together, you know, you're getting that. So, you know, it's, I mean, we probably should go out here with, you see it actually, you can find this on Spotify. I think it's called Alien Visitors Attack. They won't even tell anybody who is the author of this tune. I don't know how many people can guess who the author of that that composition is. Just raise your hands.
It's L. Ron Hubbard, and apparently it's the soundtrack to Battlefield Earth. So they did a soundtrack album for that book called Space Jazz.
Yeah, well, I don't know if he really winds up doing it, but he's the guy. But you can find a picture of him. It's a black and white picture with a, I think it's a Fender. I don't want to get that wrong, you know, because that's another one of those topics. Like, you get the kind of guitar wrong, then like you're totally canceled from the culture wars, you know, forever and ever. But it just looks like an old guy playing rock and roll and really being into it. So, you know, it's just, and you see the genius, so to speak, of L. Ron Hubbard, because I don't know when this happened, but I mean, that's really just that's a soundtrack for a video game, right? I mean, it's very modern in the sense that a lot of these other things are not. And it enables the Scientology mind to function in a way that it wants to. So, you know, it's just, there are a lot of different kinds of this kind of stuff. And you probably can have a completely fun time listening to it. Although, wait a minute, hold the phone. There's somebody we forgot, which both of us are sort of a fan of, so to speak, Mr. Mel Lyman. Mel Lyman, I mean, why don't you tell a Mel Lyman story?
Boston, right?
Boston.
Yeah, founder of the Fort Hill community. So the early 60s, he like was in this like New York City folk scene, and he ended up joining Jim Questkin's Jug Band, which are based out of Boston.
Jim Questkin's Jug Band was, speaking of somebody who happened to be there, since I'm 74, Jim Questkin was like, I mean, if you were a young hippie in New York, would-be hippie, because the hippies hadn't come around yet, if you wanted to differentiate yourself from the beatniks, who were the reigning, subcult, non-mainstream group that you wanted to be part of because you wanted to be cool, you know, they were never going to take you in because they were a bunch of snobs. They were all about, like, you know, we're the cool people and you're not. Sort of like the Andy Warhol stuff came out of that. That's why I always have never liked that kind of thing, because it was so exclusive. But by the time, I came of age, which is like in this world, like 15 or 16, and you begin smoking marijuana in high school, you know, there was this great new thing called the hippies. So that they take anybody. So, you know, you were in. You just had to grow your hair long and you were in. And you didn't even have to grow your hair long, but yeah, you do have to grow your hair long. So Jim Questkin, who was played this kind of updated retro kind of jug band music. This jug band music had been a staple of American black people, they didn't have enough instruments, so they played these jugs, and you can make it sound all these different weird ways, like, you know, when you blow on top of a Coca-Cola, bottle of Coca-Cola, makes a lot of sounds. So this was like, and you get to be an artist at doing this. So Jim Questkin, nice white boy from Boston, and people there, this was a, became a fairly famous band, especially after Maria Muldaur, who people may remember, joined it, and she was one hot number. So we, all us boys, thought that was great. And then this Mel Lyman guy came along, and he was mostly a harmonica player, and they recorded several songs. But Lyman later became a cult leader, and the best, probably the most comprehensive account of his cult thing is in a book called Acid, Post-Acid Fascism. Who wrote that? You remember?
Oh, David Felton.
Is it David Felton? Yeah. So David Felton was an old Rolling Stone, one of the original Rolling Stone writers. He wrote this book called Post-Acid Fascism, and which Mel Lyman was a major figure in. And So there are a bunch of recordings that they did, that he did when he was with the Jim Pleskin Band. There's one here called Dark as a Dungeon. I don't know this material that well, but I think we should probably play it, you know, just a little bit.
Anything called Dark as a Dungeon has to be.
Yeah.
Oh, and the ages shall roll. My body will blacken and turn into coal, and I'll look from the door of my heavenly home and pity the miner a digging my bones, for it's dark. Sun never shines. It's dark as a dungeon way down in the mine.
Well, what more do you need to know? Well, that was a lot better than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, it was like, yeah, that's that album. So Mel Lyman like moved to Boston and got, you know, that was while Timothy Leary was doing the drug experimentation at Harvard across the river and in Cambridge. And, you know, Mel really took to it, and he called what his book was Autobiography of a World Savior. And he just, yeah, he created the Fort Hill community, which I think still exists in some form, although Fort Hill doesn't still exist. And, but yeah, Jim Queskin's America is the name of the album, and it's credited to Jim Queskin co-starring Mel Lyman and the Lyman family.
That's right. The Lyman family. Well, I don't know, Lenny. See, if you were walking down the street and you heard some people playing this music that you thought was really wonderful, and you walked in and you got this cult vibes, would you stay even if the music was that great?
I mean, it's hard to say. I think about this stuff so much now that I run from everything. I mean, it's just crazy in this country at this time. I don't know if it's different or the same as 50 years ago, but I can't meet anybody without finding someone who was in a cult or had a relative in a cult. It's just like, I don't know if it's just me or if it's the culture at large, but it just seems to be everywhere.
It's probably both.
Yeah. That is a cover of Gabriel Villaranga's hit song, Energy Master, by Shy Boys out of Philadelphia. And it's the darndest thing. I was getting ready to record the episode with Mark Jacobson today, and I got an email from Max from the Shy Boys, who was like, we recorded a cover album called American Idols, and it's the music of American cults. So music from the Children of God, 12 Tribes, Synanon, Father Yod and the Source Family, Jim Jones, and it's quite an album. I got him on the phone and we spoke a little bit about it. Here it is.
Everyone knows, you know, about the Charles Manson story and how he was an aspiring songwriter. But then if you look into any of these other cults, it's like they were all aspiring songwriters. It's really weird, you know? So that's basically the idea. We did 13 songs because it's auspicious. We could have done more, you know, we could have done 100, but it's like every cult has music attached to it. And that's because it's religious, but also because, yeah, there's some weird, like, narcissistic rock star stuff going on also. But it's very consistent.
Why did you pick certain songs or not pick certain songs? And do you have a favorite?
I don't remember like what was the first song, but I have a feeling that it was, we covered a song by David Koresh. You know, there's like all these documentaries and there's this little mini series about Waco. And I don't know, somehow I found his song that he recorded, Madman in Waco. And it's like this great 80s rock song. And I don't, it's weird because the lyrics like basically are kind of talking about like what's going on during the siege. And I was like, did he record this before or after? You know, it doesn't matter, but it's a really good song. And I was like, I don't know. I just made a cover of it. And then I was like, why don't we do like a whole album of this? And then a lot of the songs actually Max picked out. And there's a couple that we're already fans of, like we cover a song by Dr. York, or he's also known as Malachi Z. York of the Nuwabian Nation and various other names. We've been a fan of his cult, I guess, you know, for a while. And it just, he happened to be also just a great like R&B singer.
The only artist that I don't recognize on the album is Wolf Zendik. Who's that?
So there's this, Zendik Farms. So they used to like proselytize. They were weird, like I don't think they were explicitly religious, but they used to like have like stands and booths in Philly and DC. I met them and they would like sell t-shirts and tapes of this guy's music. But I remember at the time, like I met them when I was in high school, and I remember Googling them and all the stuff at the time in the early 2000s was like, yeah, this is a cult. And one of the former members wrote a book. It followed like the typical cult trajectory, like a weird like sex abuse, like compound situation in the South type thing.
Well, definitely let me know if any either cult leaders contact you or people want to become followers of yours for some reason, because I think that would be a fascinating follow-up.
Do you think that Gabriel of Urantia will stumble across our thing, and what will he do when he does, or if he does, or should we send it to him? Should we be scared?
No, I think he'll go ape shit. I think you'll get a letter from a lawyer. So,
But then could we then publish that letter on Instagram just for publicity?
Yes, of course, yes. I mean, yeah.
You want my permission, or you can do whatever you want.
Well, here's the yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's raises an interesting question, because like Charles Manson's dead and L. Ron Hubbard's dead, but like
most of these people are dead except for him. He's the only one.
Oh, he's the only one.
Yeah. Or if they're not dead, they're in jail, like Malachi Z. York. The Supermax facility in Colorado. Yeah.
Malachi York, is he, when he was Malachi York, when he became a guru or whatever, was he still making music? I know that he had a band before.
Yeah, so like the one we covered was, he put out a couple albums as Dr. York in like the 80s and 90s, and the cult was fully like, yeah, they were like in full swing. I'm sure he used like the finances from his followers to pay for it, you know.
Oh yeah, I don't think any record labels were knocking him his door down trying to land a record contract with him. Thanks for listening to Failed State Update. I am Joseph L. Flatley. My co-host, J.G. Michael, will be back next time. Make sure to check out the show notes for all the relevant links. And thank you.